So just to warn you, I'm going to talk in English. So if you don't want to hear me in English, you have to run out now. It's a big honor to present today. And I really want to thank Jean-Jacques for inviting me and you for your patience, hopefully, and sticking around. So I will talk about our recent findings in human evolution, and I'll talk about the evolution and development of the human brain. And I want to show you some stuff that we published recently and research that we haven't published yet. But because I know it's a diverse audience here, I want to frame it in a bigger picture so you know why we think this is relevant for the study of human evolution. And what I want to show you is one aspect of what we think makes us modern humans unique. And the approach I'm going to take is comparing modern humans living today to our living closest relatives, chimpanzees, orangutans, and gorillas. And in particular, I'm going to show you research about pygmy chimpanzees, the bonobos. And of course, we can learn a lot about modern humans by looking at our closest fossil relatives, in this particular case, the ocelopids and the Neanderthals. And if we compare modern humans to our closest living and fossil relatives, then there are two things that stick out. So we have a very large and very complex brain, but we are also have evolved a very unusual way of walking around. We have evolved bipedal locomotion, and that is a characteristic of the hominin lineage of something that goes back millions of years. And it's important that these two characteristics did not evolve at the same time. If we look at a very schematic picture of brain size evolution, then you can see that the earliest hominins, the ocelopids, and even the earliest representative of the modern of the human lineage, in this case I put up Homo habilis, they had very small brain sizes that are comparable to brain sizes that modern apes have. And then around 1 million years ago, there seems to be almost what in this schematic looks like an explosion. And Homo sapiens and Homo neanderthalensis, they have the largest brains in the hominin lineage. And it's a bit misleading here in this graph because most of it, and Jean-Jacques mentioned this just before, most of it of this early increase has to do with an increase of body size. But in the later stages of human evolution, especially when we talk about modern humans and Neanderthals, we really have an increase in brain size that is independent of body size, and that is that happens in both lineages. So it's important for the, I would say, second part of my talk today, to understand that in both the Neanderthal lineage and in the modern human lineage, we have an independent evolution of brain size, so that would become important later. But what's important now is, for the big picture to understand, is that the bipedal locomotion, the unusual way of walking around, evolved much, much earlier than this brain size increase. So we have evidence of upright walking apes from the Chad that are maybe as old as 6 million years ago. There's some, I would say, debate and discussion whether these hominins are directly related to us, but there's absolutely no doubt that at 3.6 million years ago, there are upright walking hominins that are on our basically direct lineage, the ocelopids, and we know this because we have footprints of, in this case, Lucy and her partner, if you want, that were fossilized in an ash layer that you can directly date, and that we know that at 3.6 million years ago, these hominins walked upright. And that, of course, is much, much earlier than this brain size increase that we find in the hominin lineage. And why is this so important, this, I would say, 4 million year time gap, is because if you evolve upright walking, if you evolve bipedal locomotion, then you have to change your body. And this is a Homo sapiens compared to a gorilla, and you can see that with upright walking, a lot of changes, anatomical changes, happen to the spine and to the way that the head is positioned on the spine. So that's how we think we know that Sahelanthropus, this fossil from Chad, was an upright walking hominin, because basically the foramen magnum, the hole that connects the skull to the spine, has moved anteriorly. And then you have a very different attachment of the muscles on your thigh, and you have a change in the hip. So to be an efficient upright walking hominin, you have to have a narrow hip compared to any ape. And if you have a narrow hip, then what happens is that the size of the birth canal gets smaller, which is, of course, a bit inconvenient. If you later then, as a species, decide to put more emphasis on the baby's brain size and head size. And here you can see a schematic of the birth canal of a chimpanzee mother and a chimpanzee neonate passing through the birth canal. And you can see here why it's not a big deal for a chimpanzee mother to give birth. And when I say a big deal, of course I'm exaggerating, but it's very uncommon, for even in a zoo, that the keepers notice when a chimpanzee mother gives birth. There's only one filmed example of, you know, of all of zoos of the world, there's one film of a chimpanzee mother giving birth, even though they are, you know, under constant supervision. And it's because to them it's not as painful and dangerous as it is for a human mother. And the reason is that human mothers have to give birth through a tighter birth canal to a baby with a head that is already as large as the one of an adult chimpanzee, right? So we get born with brains that are as big as those of an adult chimpanzees, and after birth, they grow even more. And here you can see you know, how tricky the situation is. You know, the baby has to rotate twice to fit through the bony birth canal, and that is an incredibly risky strategy. And when I say risky, I mean evolutionarily risky, because that puts the mother and the child at an incredible risk of dying. And in developing countries, even today, that's one of the biggest healthcare problems, is death for the mother and the child in during childbirth. And of course, I mean, that something like this gets selected for, that's a risky strategy. And what's the solution that we have found as a species or as a lineage for the problem that, okay, you need to have narrow hips to be able to walk, and we want to have babies and adults with large brains? So the solution for the problem that we want women who are able to walk is that we've changed the way our brain grows. So this is a drawing, a classic anatomical drawing of the brain shape changes and the brain size changes before birth. And you can see that only just before birth, the brain starts to look like a modern human brain. And if we look at the growth curves, then we see, and the gray area here is what happens before birth, and everything afterwards happens after birth, is we can see that both modern humans and chimpanzees grow their brains after birth, but modern humans do so much, much longer, and at almost fetal growth rates for almost a year after birth. And there's some debate about the exact numbers, but approximately around 6 years a modern human brain is fully grown. It still matures and develops internally, but like its size doesn't change as much, and that number is much lower in chimpanzees. And of course, that means that basically the age of, or the length of childhood and extreme brain plasticity is longer in humans, which might explain some of the differences in cognitive abilities that separate modern humans from our closest living relatives. So the big difference between modern humans and chimpanzees, but that's not a big surprise. So let's look at the other large-brained human species. So let's look at Neanderthals. And let's try to learn something about us from Neanderthals. So many of you know that Neanderthals are the only real Europeans. We've just heard in Jean-Jacques' presentation before that everyone else here in the room originates from Africa, because modern humans are an African species. And what's interesting is that Neanderthals thrived under really harsh conditions in the European ice ages, but they seemingly disappeared fairly quickly after modern humans set foot in Europe. And it's not clear what happened and why that happened. So the Neanderthals seem to retreat to the south part of Europe and eventually disappear. They don't disappear completely from our genomes, but because those of us with European ancestry still carry a little bit of Neanderthal DNA in us, but like morphologically they disappear from the fossil record. And it's interesting that this happened, because Neanderthals were really well adapted to pretty harsh conditions of the Ice Age. We know that both modern humans and Neanderthals were excellent hunters, and they both went, after a wide area of large game, and they were really skilled at this. But there seem to be some differences in the way that modern humans and Neanderthals interact with their environment. For example, Neanderthals did not eat a lot of fish. Some would say ate no fish at all, and that's true for any type of marine resource. So even when they were living next to a lake or next to a river or next to the sea, they did not exploit these resources in the water as much as modern humans did. Whereas we know from modern humans, even early modern humans, is that they exploited large game, but also small animals and birds and fish and seafood. So they were much more opportunistic in the way they treated their diet. And of course, modern humans, later on, after the Neanderthals disappeared, really developed these incredible artistic expressions that I think probably the most beautiful ones you will find here in France. So this is a reproduction of Lascaux Cave, but there are even older ones in the Grotte Chauvet. And of course, you have these beautiful Venus figurines in many parts of Europe. For me, as an Austrian, the Venus of Willendorf seems to be the most important one. But of course, there are also beautiful ones in France. And many people have argued that these differences in the behavior that we see here might be related to potentially differences in cognition. And that would be interesting, because modern humans and Neanderthals both had very similar brain sizes. So their brain size ranges overlap. And what's, I think, particularly striking is that modern humans not only have smaller faces than Neanderthals, but despite their similar size, they have a really unusual brain case shape. And Jean-Jacques mentioned this before, is that what characterizes all modern humans, everyone here in the room and everyone outside, is that we have very round brain cases. And that, of course, is driven by the underlying brain. So as the brain grows and develops, prenatally and directly after birth, the brain basically pushes the brain case outward. And so we have rounder brains than Neanderthals did and than any other human species did. So we have an unusual brain case shape and brain shape. And what's unusual in modern humans compared to Neanderthals, especially, is this bulging parietal region and an expanded cerebellum. And what's interesting is that we're not born that way. So here in the semi-transparent skull here is an adult, a modern human adult, and this is the endocast of a neonate, so a modern human baby a few days after birth. And what's interesting is that this is very elongated and not round at all. And if we scale it to the size of a Neanderthal, you can see that modern humans, when they're babies, and Neanderthals look very much alike. So we tried to apply some of the methods that Jean-Jacques talked about in the first part today, the methods called geometric morphometrics, to look at the statistical shape changes of the endocast. So we make these imprints of the brain case on the computer based on computed tomographic scans, and then we measure hundreds of measurement points, these so-called semi-landmarks on endocasts. And we did this in a cross-sectional sample of chimpanzees and modern humans. And when I say cross-sectional sample, I talk about, in this case, chimpanzee babies that grow up to be adults and modern human babies that grow up to be adults. And this, like in the previous presentation, is a principal component analysis of endocranial shape. So we have so basically we see the trends, the large scale trends in the data set, and these are not growth curves in the sense that you can see here that something is going fast, but these are shape changes. What is interesting is that as soon as the deciduous dentition is erupted, so that would be the age group 2 in modern humans, to age group 6, these are the adults, and here's the same in chimpanzees growing up to be adults, we have a lot of similarities, and we call this a shared phase. So basically you could switch the ontogenetic trajectory of a chimpanzee and a modern human, and they would look very similar. But between birth and the eruption of the deciduous dentition, so we're talking about the shape changes in the first year of life, generally speaking, we have a shape change that does not occur in chimpanzees. And we call this the globularization phase because during this time period, the elongated brain case of a modern human baby becomes more globular and changes to the characteristic shape that everyone here in this audience has. And it does it by expanding the cerebellum and bulging the parietal area. So because these are the changes or the shape differences that also separate modern human adults from Neanderthal adults, we then try to ask the question, okay, do Neanderthals also have a globularization phase or not? And to this end, we reconstructed Neanderthal babies. And this is a 3D animation of a virtual reconstruction based on computer tomographic scans of a Neanderthal baby. So we CT scanned the individual parts that are really extremely fragile. And then I spent 3 months of my life with migraine clicking on the computer screen to reassemble, in this case, two Neanderthal babies. One from France, from Le Moustier, and this one is from Mesmaiskaya in Russia. And on the computer, the nice thing is that you can try many, many times. You can mirror image one side to the other. And so we created multiple reconstructions of Neanderthal babies. And what we found is that indeed, even as babies, you could instantly recognize a Neanderthal baby because it has a much larger face than a modern human baby and a bigger nose and all these things that differentiate a modern human from a Neanderthal as adult. You can already see in a neonate but you wouldn't be able to tell, or only with a lot of experience, that their endocasts, the imprints of their brain cases, would be any different. So Neanderthals and modern humans had very similar brain shapes at the time of birth, and also very similar brain volumes. You can see here that the semi-transparent blue one is the modern human baby, and the red one is the Neanderthal baby, and they really almost look exactly the same. And if we analyze this along with Neanderthal adults and several other Neanderthal kids, then we find that indeed, after birth, Neanderthals do not have a globularization phase like modern humans do. They grow according to this shared phase that we share with humans and chimpanzees and also other hominoids. So gibbons and gorillas and orangutans also have this shared phase of postnatal endocranial development. So there seems to be a difference in the way that the brain grows, and that is really interesting. But of course, I told you before that we also know that there's a big shift in the way modern humans grow compared to chimpanzees. So we wanted to know whether chimpanzees, at least, because we don't have any Neanderthal individuals that are younger than neonates, but we wanted to know, at least for chimpanzees, whether they have a globalization phase that happens before birth, right? So let's look at these shape changes again. So that happens after birth in modern humans. So we have this expansion of the cerebellum and this bulging of the parietal area, and that, and here this is a little bit exaggerated, but that makes the modern human brain case and brain more globular than anyone else. And what's interesting in this movie is that we've color-coded not only the shape changes you can see as in the movie, but we've color-coded the relative size increase of these areas. And red areas really do increase in size, and blue areas increase a little bit, and white areas increase not at all. And what you can see is that this parietal bulging is actually a displacement. It's not so much that we have an expansion of the parietals during ontogeny. It gets displaced by something else, and we'll talk about the something else later. Okay, so I introduced to you before the research that modern humans undergo a globularization phase of the brain case directly after birth, and then as soon as the deciduous dentition is erupted, everyone basically grows the same. Chimpanzees, humans, Neanderthals, gorillas, gibbons. But very little is known about the fetal development in humans and other species, so what we wanted to know is whether our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees and bonobos, undergo a prenatal globalization phase. And if this were the case, then one would still be interesting, but maybe a little bit less so, because that would mean that this globalization phase is not something that's uniquely modern human, but it's just shifted from before birth to after birth. And we would call this heterochrony, that the same developmental mechanism gets shifted in development, but doesn't really change per se. And as a secondary aim, what we wanted to know is whether growth rate of the brain affects brain shape. And our previous research was based on micro CT scans of skulls. So we had these beautiful high resolution micro CT scans of chimpanzees and humans from museum collections. The problem, of course, is if you want to understand development, is that these skulls necessarily are obviously dead. So, and as such, of course, they don't develop and they don't grow anymore, and they don't tell us much about individual development. So what we wanted to do is overcome this limitation of working with a skeletal material and work with living bonobos. So we started a large-scale collaboration with zoos all over Europe and the US, and tried to scan pregnant bonobo mothers and tried to capture images of the fetal brain development as they were growing. And the challenge was that we did not sedate the animals. Instead, they were trained to volunteer for the examination, so they were giving treats. And so we call this positive, or they call this positive reinforcement, and it was all done under supervision of the local keepers and done by Barbara Dreves, who is a trained veterinarian. And we used these ultrasound machines that you would also use for modern human babies to monitor a pregnancy. And these are the images you would get. And in the best case scenario, I would say, you get beautiful images like this, where you can actually see, this is the face, and here is the brain and the brain case and the spine of a bonobo baby during pregnancy. Okay. And then we tried to combine these data with the data that we already had from the skeletal material, and we tried to analyze them using a very simple metric, because the beauty of the micro-CT scans is that we can analyze it with really sophisticated statistical methods and using hundreds of measurement points. That's unfortunately, at least at this point, not possible using the ultrasound images, because they're just too noisy, because everything moves, the sound waves, the mother, the baby inside the mother. So we get fairly noisy images, and we therefore applied the same trick that pediatricians apply when they monitor a human pregnancy. We calculated very simple shape indices to describe the size and shape of the brain. So you take the biparietal diameter and the frontal occipital diameter, and you divide one by the other, and if the brain shape is very round, then this index is 1, and the smaller it is, this index indicates that it's an elongated brain shape. And here we can see that it's a simple metric. This is called a cephalic index, but it captures the shape changes during the globularization phase quite nicely. So it does not capture everything, but I think it captures the key aspect of the globularization phase. And that's the shape changes that we see in modern humans. And this is based on clinical data from hundreds and hundreds of modern human babies. And you can see that modern humans actually start to become globular around week 27. And that continues after birth. And then we asked, what do bonobos do? And they do, I wouldn't say the exact opposite, but they do something very, very different. So bonobos become more globular very early in pregnancy, but then they stop being globular, so they become more elongated and then eventually don't change their shape anymore just before birth. And what's interesting here is that we have these, I would say, inflection points of the curve at week 27 for humans and at week 20 for bonobos. And that coincides with changes in growth rate. So in week 20, the bonobo growth rate slows down, whereas modern humans continue to grow at very fast rates. And in week 27, that's when the cerebellum really starts to pick up growth, right? So there seems to be a cerebellar growth spurt, a prenatal cerebellar growth spurt, that I would say is largely responsible for this prenatal globalization in modern humans. And what you can see here is the the result of fortune or accident, if you want. So we captured this bonobo baby at week 22 prenatally, so that's the fetus, and I highlighted the bone. And unfortunately, this bonobo baby died 5 months after birth. So it died from an infection, and the zoo was gracious enough to allow us to CT scan this individual. So we can now compare, you know, the same individual prenatally and postnatally. And if we scale, the baby, the infant to fetal size, we can see that at least in the mid-sagittal aspect, there are no changes whatsoever in cranial shape, right? So there is no prenatal globularization phase in bonobos, at least not directly before birth. So bonobos do not change their shape. They increase in size, but they don't change their shape anymore. And that's, I would say, the exact opposite of what modern humans would do. So what we found is that modern humans do have a prenatal globularization phase that started at week 27. And bonobos have something like a globularization phase prenatally, but it happens much earlier, so it's not a simple heterochronic shift. And I think it might not be even comparable to what's happening here. And if it is, then we don't have the data to support this yet, but it might be related to the expansion of the cerebellum in bonobos as well. And what's really important is that, yes, there seems to be a connection between the growth rate of the brain and the brain shape changes, and the brain becomes more globular during phases of rapid growth. So that, I think, is probably the most important finding that we get from this, longitudinal data, from the ability to study, you know, the same individual over multiple time steps, is that it really seems to be the expansion rate of the brain or parts of the brain that drive this globalization phase. And why is this? Is because I want to emphasize that what I'm trying to argue for is not a new type of phrenology. You know, I'm not trying to convince you that, oh, because somebody has a round head versus an elongated head, that this shape of the head is in any way tied to cognition. Not at all. So I'm not trying to argue that, you know, having a round head makes you you know, want to go fishing or you know, try to create cave paintings. Quite the opposite. I don't think that there's any plausible connection between the actual brain shape and cognitive measures. But what's interesting is that these shape changes occur during a period of a complete reorganization of the brain, right? So it's very telling that this happens very early prenatally and in the first years of life, because we are all born with almost the same number of brain cells that we have as adults, but at the time of birth, they're hardly connected. So this network of the brain that gets established after birth, and the stimuli of the environment and how you interact with the environment that shapes these connections. And it's really interesting that, so this is an area of active research, of course, so there's a lot we don't know about the way the brain is connected and how this is guided. But what we do know is that these axons are guided by chemical cues that depend on the spatial patterning of these cues in the developing brain, and that not every connection in the brain is genetically predetermined. That would also be, you know, just the sheer numbers would make that impossible, because we have billions of connections in our brain and only 25,000 genes that make our body. So it's impossible that every brain connection is genetically predetermined. So in a way, it's a self-organizing process, and when you grow and how you grow makes a difference. I'll try to illustrate this not by doing a sophisticated simulation, but by changing the parameters of a screensaver. So I found this screensaver online that tries to simulate fireflies. So you have a target, and you have fireflies, and maybe this also works or not, you see. Okay, so that would be the standard setting of the screensaver, and I'm just trying to illustrate that a very, very subtle change in the speed of brain growth can have a huge effect on the way this network is developing. So that would be the standard setting, and we can change the speed of growth by changing slow growth, and you can see that I just changed basically the speed of the firefly, and it would create a very, very different network structure. And here I made it speed up. And again, I'm not trying to simulate the actual, you know, growth of a brain. I'm not trying to pretend it's as simple as, you know, this screensaver simulating a firefly. But I'm just trying to argue that by changing this developmental speed in the brain, you basically change the architecture of the network. And you can make a more sophisticated, or it's actually not more sophisticated, but it looks more sophisticated. So I simulated the brain as being perfectly spherical, and I just changed the speed of these connections, and then I analyzed the graph properties of this network. And you have, you know, with one setting, you have very localized connectivity, and with just a very, very subtle change, you have a completely different graph network. You get this large-scale network by just modifying, you know, simple parameters in the way the brain grows. And something like this at a much more complicated scale, I think, happens in the evolution of human brains as well. And here you can see that these are actual data, these are not fireflies, but here you can see the prenatal brain wiring. This is the white matter from a diffusion tensor image of a fetus, of a modern human fetus. And this is the network of a three-year-old. And you can really see that, you know, every fiber here represents millions of nerves and connections. And you can really see that this happens a little bit before birth, but a large scale network properties are established after birth in the under the impressions of the environment. And basically, the take-home message is that if you have children and grandchildren, then, you know, you have to be particularly careful how you treat them in the very first year of life, because that is maybe the most important area and the most important time for the development of these cognitive abilities that seem, you know, particularly important in recent modern human evolution. So I have a lot of people to thank for that made this research possible, and of course I want to thank you for your attention. And if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them now, or you can also send me an email at some point later, and I can also send you papers, whatever you want. Thank you very much.